our next presentation is going to be by Dr. Elizabeth Andrade. Dr. Andrade is an assistant research professor in the Department of Prevention and Community Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health. She is committed to public health practice and research that reduces health disparities among Latino immigrants in D.C. and communities in Latin America. She has worked in the areas of substance abuse, sexual risk, and intimate partner violence.
Now the trick is going to be seeing me behind this podium. I'm kidding. That's all right. Okay, so thank you very much. So I'm going to present results from a study that we did. It's going to be a little bit different than what you just heard, but I think it will go very nicely. Thank you very much for the setup. Because a lot of the things that I'm going to present on clarify and provide a little more context to some of the findings from the study you just heard about. Without further ado, I'll go ahead and get started. I have the wrong date. Sorry about that. I have no conflicts to disclose. So what I'm going to do is present first the overall issue that I'm of gender-based violence, and then discuss the methods of our study results, and then discuss a little bit about what it means for public health research and practice, and make some recommendations. So gender-based violence, as we've heard, very similar to intimate partner violence, it's widespread worldwide and associated with a lot of negative social, physical health consequences. We've all heard about that already. By gender-based violence, I mean violence that's directed at an individual based on his or her biological sex, gender identity, or perceived adherence to socially defined norms of masculinity or femininity. And these can include everything from physical violence, psychological abuse, threats, coercion, deprivation, et cetera. So GBV has been widely researched among U.S. populations, as we've heard, but there are fewer studies that focus on racial and ethnic minorities, and I'm going to be presenting on Latino immigrant population. So why Latinos? I've been working with Latino immigrant populations for about, I'd say a little over a decade, specifically in the Washington, D.C. area. They are the fastest growing racial ethnic minority in the United States. By about 2015, they'll be almost 30% of the U.S. population. So estimates of lifetime GBV prevalence among U.S. Latinas range anywhere from 19 to 35% for physical violence, 8 to 36% for sexual violence, almost 5% to 22% for stalking, and 12 to 51% for threats, intimidation, and coercion. And a lot of the references are in the end if you'd like some of those studies with those statistics. Research exploring Latino immigrant GBV determinants and specific contexts that exacerbate their vulnerability are really limited, looking at the immigrant experience and the immigrant trajectory, as has been mentioned. And there's a lot of variation between Latino subgroups, Chicano, Cuban, Puerto Rican, and Central American. They're all very different in their experiences, in their immigrant trajectory, in the communities they live in. And so I do think there is a lot of research needed to really understand these differences and identify populations that are disproportionately vulnerable, isolated, and underserved. And so our study did focus on primarily Central American immigrants who are more recently arrived, a large proportion of undocumented immigrants, and living just outside the Washington, D.C. area. So I'll describe them now. So again, this is probably not new, but immigrant Latinos face considerable challenges during the process of integration and assimilation. As my colleague was referring, a lot of the stressors that are experienced are really contributors to gender-based violence, to emotional distress, to poor mental health outcomes. And some of those that they experience, as we've heard, again, to reinforce the previous presentation, is stress is related to acculturation, being linguistically, socially, culturally isolated, family separation, and these severed social networks, where, especially for Latino immigrants, having a strong family network and neighbor network is extremely important to emotional well-being. Barriers to accessing services, living in fear of deportation, and experiencing economic challenges, and even discrimination, racism, unstable employment. And these are all factors that we see in the community that we have been working in. One thing I also want to point out is that a lot of Latino immigrants in our community that I'm going to describe to you in a minute come with a mindset of, you know, of the way it was in their home country, both the overall social context, legal frameworks, social interactions, acceptability of violence or of gender-based violence, and many of the study participants mentioned that, well, we tried to apply a lot of what we knew here in the U.S., and a lot of it was irrelevant, didn't apply here. I had to adapt, I had to change everything I knew to a totally different context. And that's kind of the overarching theme of my presentation of our study, is this changes in context and culture it was an overarching theme and what a lot of participants described. So there have been a lot of studies that have looked at structural and cultural determinants of GBV among Latinos and have mentioned a lot of the factors that I've described, and additional ones that have been seen in the literature are shifts in machismo, and as I just mentioned, the perceived destabilization of masculinity. Machismo is less relevant in the U.S., and I'll describe a number of reasons as to why that is true, according to our study participants. The changes in gender role provided a lot of stressors, so for addressing gender-based violence among immigrant Latinos, especially in communities like the one I'm going to describe, is extremely challenging. A lot of the barriers for this population to access services include things like scarcity of services that are appropriate for them, prepared to deliver services that are linguistically, culturally competent, the fact that they have a hard time paying for services, or they're ineligible to even receive services, especially county-provided services, because of their undocumented status. A lot of members of this community are unaware of their rights, don't understand that they're actually protected from this type of violence, and especially communities, as we are seeing across the nation, with a drastic influx of undocumented or sometimes unaccompanied minors from Central America, they're just less equipped and with the resources to really meet the needs of the population. And so that's I would say, also true for the community I'll describe. So the study I'm going to provide results for was a study that was conducted from 2008 to 2011 in Langley Park, Maryland, which is an urban area just north of Washington, D.C., and it's the same community I've been working in for about a decade. Washington, D.C. has been a major destination for immigrants, especially from Central America, primarily El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and then lesser so, but also substantial numbers of immigrants from Mexico, the Caribbean, and then, of course, South American, primarily Peruvian, Bolivian. The state of Maryland in particular, where Langley Park is located, has seen about 107% increase in Latino residents from 2000 to 2010. So this study was part of a larger study where we collected both qualitative and quantitative data. We did a survey using a two-stage cluster sample, going door-to-door, knocking on doors, and interviewing people about gender-based violence. And this, what I'm going to present the results of, is the qualitative portion that helped to help us to understand some of the results from the survey. So our goal was, it was really an etiologic study. We just wanted to know what is going on here. What kind of, at different levels, what are the determinants? What are people saying is causing gender-based violence in this community? And how is their experiences in their home country with gender-based violence during transition to the U.S. and in the U.S. context, how are they the same? How are they different? How do they change over time? Okay, so really we were looking for determinants of GBV at different levels. Okay, so the study population is Langley Park, Maryland, predominantly low income. They have a third, their median family income is about a third of the income for Maryland families. 90% of students receive free or reduced price lunches, mostly foreign-born, mostly Latino, limited English proficiency. Limited English proficiency. I think it's only 15% of residents are comfortable speaking and communicating in English, And the statistic here is for low levels of educational attainment. So you'll see people who have no formal education, a third grade level of education, and then half of adults in the community have not completed ninth grade. Okay, so we interviewed, I'm going to present on interviews, individual interviews that we conducted with 36 males and 20 males between the ages of 15 and 60. And females were oversampled because of the tendency to be more victimized. So we conducted individual interviews. We were using a standardized protocol, and we did it in two phases. And the goal was really to discover themes that were mentioned across participants, but then to also leave a little bit of flexibility in the research design to identify factors that emerged that were unique to that immigrant groups or that individual's trajectory in terms of their experiences transitioning to the U.S. So the phase one and phase two interviews were rather similar, but phase one was with general community members. Phase two was with those who had said that they were victims of violence in the U.S. And if you're interested in the demographics, mostly from, you know, this is reflective of community demographics, mostly Guatemalan, from El Salvador, and also, you know, we sampled from other countries. The phase two had more South American representation. Okay. So interviews were all audio recorded, transcribed, analyzed in QSR and Vivo software, double coded by myself and by another individual. We used a preliminary code book, but then expanded that to take into account information that arose outside of the predetermined areas of inquiry. And we identified concepts and themes that were shared experiences, but then also that were unique. Okay. So I'm going to first describe what the study participants mentioned about the home country setting, and then talk about the U.S. setting, and any quotes that are from males are denoted with an M. Okay, so I'm going to dive right into results here. Okay. Ooh, okay. I wonder if I can get them all to come up at once. No. Okay, we're going to do them one at a time. Didn't know that was like that. So, all right. So the most common forms of gender-based violence in the home country were more physical abuse and control by partner, and to a lesser extent, verbal abuse and sexual abuse. So one that I want to share, sorry, let's see if I can get this to do what I want. So he was so aggressive, verbally and physically, it was sad and painful. People would mention sexual abuse and coercion, being invited to vacant houses and taken advantage of, those kinds of things, but it was very rare that people would mention that. He would give me 5 minutes to go to the store, and if I wasn't back, he would bring me back, pulling me by my hair and kicking me. It was horrible. He broke my nose. So there was a lot more physical abuse. Okay. They also, participants also described a much more violent home country. It's not a big deal to see dead people because we come from countries with a lot of violence. It's almost normal, although it doesn't have to be normal, right? So a lot of the participants came from countries that were had experienced, you know, war, civil strife, and had seen lots of violent experiences. So it was more or less normalized. And the mistreatment of women was also common. And the participants described this as something happening over generations. So my kids see their parents and they think this dynamic and they think it's acceptable. Violence generates violence. Another quote was, "In my country, violence is very common. Most women are mistreated." Okay. Machismo, I'm sure you've all heard of that construct, and it's a cultural construct that describes the interaction, the accepted interaction between men and women, that the male is dominant, the decision maker, the protector. There's a lot of positive and maybe not so positive ways to understand machismo. But where in the home country, men were described as traditionally in charge. It reinforced a lot of the inequities and a lot of challenges to women being protected and having rights. Women were typically in the home. Back home, the man works and you're in charge of the house. This made women much more financially dependent on their partners because they did not work. And men were more trusting of their female partners because they were at home, they were with the neighbor, he knew where she was, she was accounted for, no questions asked, and on the other hand, he was able to engage in much more extramarital affairs because she won't complain. She has the house and the maid. Okay, it was an accepted thing that participants described. Okay, my word is always stronger than hers, is the what was said. Barriers to seeking help. It was described as a private matter, GBV. Other challenges were that in our countries, it's hard to get help. They don't even listen to us. So many women turned up beheaded, mutilated, because they went to the police station to file a complaint and nobody did anything. So there was really a limited rights and protection of women. Many times because the men worked outside the home, they had money in their pocket to pay off judges, to pay off police, whereas the woman did not. And so he would be let go and she had no defense. So he had money and I didn't, so they set him free. Mm-hmm. Another thing that was mentioned was just really systematic corruption. Some women described where they would go to the police station to report violence, and the police would actually say, "So when are we going to go out?" And she goes, "What do you mean, when are we going to go out?" And he goes, "Well, you do for me, I do for you. You can't help me, I can't help you." That's sometimes what they would face going to the police station to actually report abuses. One protective factor back home was social support. But one woman described it as, back home people hear things, they call the police, but the state is against you. So even if they were to try to report violence, or their neighbor would call, or their family would defend them, in the end, the perpetrator would likely not be prosecuted and nothing would really be done. And some women described, if I call the police, when he gets out of jail, he'll just hit me harder. So people really didn't stand up for themselves. I'm going to move on to the US context. So you kind of get an idea. Back home, in the home countries, it was fairly consistent that women had less rights, there was much more corruption, no prosecution of violence, and it was a drastic change in coming to the U.S. context. So there were a lot of challenges in transition, which I've already described, but some of the most common forms of GBV in the U.S. that were reported, there was a lot less physical violence reported and a lot more domination, control, stalking, verbal abuse, and financial abuse. And I do also want to point out that it is very true that women were usually the victims, but not always. Men did report victimization, especially when it came to verbal abuse and domination and control. And I'll describe why. So he threatened at me and bossed me around. He said I shouldn't work. I wouldn't even eat without having to ask him for it. He abused me economically. He made me pay for cable, electricity, and he spent $300 monthly on AT&T. Everything was in my name, so I had to pay. And financial abuse and economic abuse was something we did not hear about in the home country at all. We did hear about in the U.S. context. So as I mentioned, physical abuse came less common as perpetrators started to discover that, wow, police will actually show up and actually do something. And so they became aware of their rights. Women would find out from neighbors or coworkers that they actually had rights and that they could do something about it. He wanted to hit me, and I said, "You'll never touch me here. You're not going to touch me again." That's how I stood up to him. He called the police and they told him, "You either behave or we'll take you." So then he knew he couldn't touch me. Men described a lot of verbal abuse. Women will scream at you, "You're a lazy bum, get up, we have to feed the kids." And men feel devalued when they hear these words from their partner. Okay. So there were a lot of individual factors mentioned that were described as exacerbating gender-based violence. And some of them were depression, alcohol abuse, and feelings of isolation. "There's a lot of depression. We don't have much to hope for," is what one man said. There are people alone without family, and at get-togethers, they get drunk too much. They drink too much, and everything starts from there. So alcohol was definitely, as seen in the literature, a very common contributor. Isolation makes it extremely easy for partner violence to go unnoticed. Here, you don't see it because there's no social activity and people hide it. So not only was that a contributor, it also made people less likely to reach out for help, and having GBV be less visible. The economics of changing gender roles. So one of the biggest findings, I think, from our study was that the change in gender roles. Women were now in the workplace because they had to. They had to work. Both people had to have an income to survive. But women actually were much more viable in the workplace. They found jobs, they fit in anywhere. They could do nanny work, cleaning work, kitchen work, service, you know, they could even do construction and take jobs that were traditionally male jobs. And men found a much harder time finding work, seasonal work, day laboring work, and so it really turned gender roles on its head, causing a lot of stress, especially for the male partner. And so what would happen is, men realized they had to let go of machismo. The man practices more machismo and subordination back home, but here both are equals. Okay. In the newspapers, there are a lot of ads for nannies, and they're not going to hire a man. There's a lot of opportunity for women. For a man, it's hard to find a job in construction. So this really tipped the scales of power. With women having more freedoms, they're out in the street, they're working, they're out and about, they have an income, they also ended up having more power in the relationship. Okay? Here, men feel bad because that's why they become furious, because women have support here. Men consider themselves masters of the couple, and he'll use whatever situation to humiliate or hit his partner. So what happened is the male response to this tipping of power is men would reassert their power through violence or control or stalking, following them to and from their workplace in an attempt to rebalance the scales. Okay. A man who brings his woman here starts to have problems because it won't be the same. She'll no longer cook and iron and everything for him. Okay? So women also use this newfound power to defend themselves and express their point of view. Women are not like before, submissive and quiet. This country gives us freedom of expression to say what we feel and look for help. There is also a growing mistrust among men. They would worry about their women meeting someone else. I would be uncomfortable that she goes out with her girlfriends, and then there are guy friends, and then you don't know what she's doing. Okay? Keep going. I'm going to jump along, yeah. The one final finding I wanted to share before skipping along to closing the presentation was this finding of a relationship market. A lot of people would migrate sequentially to the U.S. without their partner, and they found themselves very uncomfortable because they didn't know how to fill the other gender role. A man was uncomfortable cooking and cleaning, didn't know what to do, and the female felt like she needed protection. And so what happened is these relationships would form solely for the purpose of filling a gender role or for some purpose other than a romantic relationship. And I called it this relationship market, and it was very, very common and widespread in our community. It's not something I've seen in the literature. These relationships were much more, reported much more of violence. So when people are not together for love, there's more violence. The tolerance threshold is not the same, and violence can occur. Okay? So I'm just going to move forward. So I'm not going to share quotes for this one, but some of the barriers to seeking help in the U.S. were just not knowing about services, language barriers, the typical barriers you see among immigrant populations, fear of deportation, and one of the big ones was pride or embarrassment, especially among men, to admit that they had been abused by their female partner. So I'm just going to move through this one. Some of the limitations were that this was a primarily Central American group, and the findings cannot be representative necessarily of other communities from other countries. What I would just like to do is skip to the recommendations. There are three recommendations that we had. Some of them were reinforced by Dr. Kimber's presentation, is that immediately upon immigrating to the U.S., we recommend that mental health and substance abuse issues should really be addressed because they were some of the major individual level contributing factors. The focus really should be on this vulnerable transition period of recently arrived immigrants, helping them understand their rights in the U.S., what are the laws around gender-based violence, helping them transition in a way that is less stressful for them, because the stressors are what we're contributing to partner violence, gender-based violence, and expanding of services to meet the needs of this population that are culturally competent and available regardless of legal status. Okay, those were our recommendations. So the references I'd be glad to share if you'd like them. And that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.